from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on this morning's forum program, Harvard cognitive scientist and linguist Steven Pinker will join us to talk about best practices of modern writing. He'll talk about which grammar rules we should follow, which ones don't make sense, and why you should avoid cliches like the plague. Pinker's new book is called The Sense of Style, The Thinking Person's Guide to Writing in the 21st Century. Then, in his new documentary, Capturing Grace, filmmaker and former Forum host Dave Iverson follows a group of Parkinson's patients whose sometimes crippling symptoms are ameliorated through learning to dance with teachers from the renowned Mark Morris Dance Group. The film premieres at the Mill Valley Film Festival later this week. Forum is next. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's forum program. Steven Pinker joins us in studio for this second hour and the opening segment of our second hour. In today's edition, linguistics researcher, cognitive scientist, professor of psychology at Harvard. He's also the author of such books as The Language Instinct, Words and Rules, and The Stuff of Thought. And he chairs the usage panel of the American Heritage Dictionary. His newest book is The Sense of Style, The Thinking Person's Guide to Writing in the 21st Century. Steven Pinker joins us. Good to have you back on Forum. Welcome.
Thank you.
You're taking on some pretty heavy-duty adversaries here. And I mean, you know, those who almost have become George Orwell, Strunk and White, become almost major in terms of what is at least considered to be style. And when I say you take them on, I mean, you know, some of the severity of the rules seem to you to be silly. Cockamamie used that word at one point, ridiculous. And it really ties in with, I think, what I especially liked about the book, which is that linguistics is a field that's constantly adaptive and constantly changing. And in many ways, these guys are out of touch with what we are today.
Yes. Well, they're both the iconic elements of style by Strunk and White and the politics in the English language assigned to every college freshman. They are definitely worth reading. There's a lot of good advice in them.
Agreed.
But on the other hand, there's a lot of baffling advice as well. Strunk and White say you must never use words of number with people. You can't say three people. You must say three persons. Uh-huh. Why not? They ban these trendy, newfangled jargon words like to contact and to finalize. They were opposed to the use of to fix, meaning to repair. And what happens, of course, is that language changes. And what appears as fancy new lingo or jargon in one era might be an unexceptionable part of the language in the next. So usage guides have to keep up with the language, which changes. But also, I think it no longer works to just give a bunch of do's and don'ts. And when pressed for reason, say because I said so, or because that's the way my ear works. We really understand a lot more about language than we did when Orwell or when Strunk and White wrote, and we can give advice that's more motivated by what we know about how language works. And so instead of just following a rule robotically, like, oh, passives are bad, so every time I see a passive sentence like the man was bitten by the dog, I'll change it to the active, the dog bit the man. That's sometimes good advice, and sometimes it's bad advice. And only if you understand how the language works can you understand the rationale for the advice and know when to apply it, when not to apply it.
Well, you bring modern linguistics and cognitive science into the empiricism and the research into how we understand the ways in which language works. Talk about the passive voice, though, for a moment, because as an English teacher of many years, I used to have students who would come in and use it, and because high school teachers told them they had to use it, you'd be objective, you know, and they didn't had to take themselves out of it. And I would say to them, pretty much what you're saying, yeah, take yourself out of it, but also own up to, you know, when you take responsibility for your ideas, you don't want to put it necessarily in the passive voice. And it was a good rule sometimes of thumb to say, use the active voice when you're presenting your own ideas. You want to own them. You want to have agency over them.
That's right. You know, a lot of academic prose is so turgid and bloated and stuffy because it overuses the passive voice. On the basis of the analysis which was performed on the data which were collected, it is suggested that the null hypothesis can be rejected.
That's very good, Steve. I like that.
I've been in academia for a long time. I know
we could talk academies for the rest of the time we have together here.
I know how to dispense the sludge as well as anyone. But it makes for bad writing. And it's also not, it doesn't make the prose any more scientific. And in fact, as you note, often the passive is a way of evading responsibility, as in the infamous mistakes were made, which we heard yet again last week when the director of the Secret Service testified before Congress on how it was that a guy with a knife managed to sneak into the White House. And she said, oh, mistakes were made. Yeah. Julia Pearson, it didn't save her hide. She had to resign anyway.
We're talking again with Steven Pinker. His new book is called The Sense of Style. And the sense. I mean, that's an important word in this title, isn't it?
It serves a dual purpose. It's sense as opposed to nonsense, because there's a lot of nonsense about style that's out there, and sense of intuition, feeling, capacity, what goes into our sense that a sentence is well written or pleasing to the ear or clear, as opposed to confusing, ambiguous, bloated, and so on.
It's also sensibility, too.
Sensibility, absolutely.
Yeah. With all this jargon, though, one sometimes laments and says, would that we could only get back to standard English and use standard English and all of that sort of thing. But the truth of the matter is, and I was confounded by this. I'm quoting from your book here, moral panic about the decline of writing may be as old as writing itself. And you go back to the Sumerians?
There's one scholar who claims that some of the earliest inscriptions in cuneiform were lamenting the declining skills of the young at writing cuneiform.
Yeah, but the complaints go on, and the complaints particularly on a generational level. And a lot of those complaints have to do with again, these rules and the severity of these rules are what people think is absolutely necessary when it comes to grammar.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of bad writing out there. I think it's deplorable. I think it should stop. We should get better at writing. I think it has I don't think it's a sin of young people, and I don't believe in the young people suck school of cultural criticism. As we get older, we become more attentive to many things, including the quality of writing. And every generation thinks that the kids today are ruining the language. But, you know, kids grow up and they pay more attention to language and the language survives.
Don't you think the internet has had an impact, though, on perhaps some deterioration? I mean, texting as opposed to working out ideas in an expository way or in a critical thinking way?
No, they have nothing to do with each other. The fact that you can text doesn't mean that someone's holding a gun to your head and saying you may only text. You text and you write essays. We always have many forms of the language that we use depending on the audience, depending on the medium. The fact that we have the ability to tweet, to text, to instant message doesn't mean that that's the only way we use language.
Talk about garden paths. This is what linguistics talk about a great deal.
Yes. So a garden path is a temporary ambiguity. It's a way of interpreting a sentence when you're a few words into it that turns out not to be the correct meaning. And so it forces you to backtrack and to reanalyze the sentence all over again. There are a number of that are used that are in textbooks in psycholinguistics to illustrate the point, like fat people eat accumulates. Now, it's very hard to understand what that means because you think it's about fat people, but it does have an actual parse, namely the fat that people eat accumulates. And it's a perfectly grammatical sentence, but it's very hard to understand. So that's an extreme example of a phenomenon that you see in a lot of clumsy prose where you kind of hit a wall and you have to go back to the beginning of the sentence because the writer led the reader up the garden path.
Often happens with dangling modifiers, for example. Mm-hmm.
Dangling modifiers can lead to ambiguities like you know, plunging more than 1,000 feet. We enjoyed the sight of Yosemite Falls, where it sounds like we plunged.
Right.
Although it is not true that dangling modifiers are a grammatical error. There are many of them that just pass by unnoticed. They do create the possibility of an ambiguity, and so you shouldn't be ambiguous. But it's not correct to say that dangling modifiers are a violation of English grammar.
What about saying that on the sentence level, people should not write sentence fragments or not write run-on sentences when you find, you know, some of the greatest writers, Hemingway, fragments, Faulkner run-ons.
Absolutely. And all good writers sometimes use sentence fragments. There's a difference between the kind of rules that you give to kids in elementary school to just get them to understand the basics of where you put the period and where you capitalize, and advice for grown-up writers. And rules like never begin a sentence with and, or with because, or with but, are, you know, maybe pedagogically useful ways of getting kids to know what a sentence is, but they are not good as advice for writers in general.
When you mention periods, I often think about Isaac Babel, who said, if I have it right, no iron can stab the heart with such force as a period put just in the right place. And I had a colleague for many years, Eugene Grunt, may he rest in peace, or if he's still alive, please let me know, Gene Grunt, because I don't know, but it's been many years ago, who said, you know, who talked about the affinity and the wonderful delectation that he had in using the semicolon, and how you know, it was an extraordinary. I mean, punctuation can indeed enhance style to such a greater degree and do so much more to enhance writing than most people realize.
Absolutely. And even though I think there are a lot of rules out there that ought to be flouted because they just shouldn't have been in the rule books to begin with, like not ending a sentence with a preposition, not using a split infinitive.
Forgive me, you know the Winston Churchill response to that. That is something up with which I will not put.
This is pedantry up with which I will not put, which, and it turns out he didn't say it.
But another disappointment.
Just like everything that Mark Twain said, he didn't really say, or a lot of things.
Like the summer in San Francisco. Yeah, he never said that.
Exactly. So an editorialist for the Wall Street Journal did say it, and then it like many quotations, it floated up to the most famous quote dispenser.
This is why we need Steve Pinker in the world. Iconoclastic as you may be, but giving us the right attribution.
But back to punctuation. I tend to be more of a stickler in punctuation, that a comma splice, that is when you have two sentences that are joined with independent sentences, like your talk is at 5 p.m., comma, it is preceded by a coffee hour. That drives me up the wall, just because it's inconsiderate to the reader. It leads the reader to, as we spoke earlier, a garden path. They have to go back and read the sentence a second time to figure out what it means. And you're right that gifted stylists use punctuation because punctuation in part reflects timing and emphasis and melody. It's a way to get your reader to recreate the music of the language, which otherwise would be lost in the printed page.
Again, our guest is Steven Pinker, and we invite you to join this conversation if you have questions or comments about style. His book is Sense of Style, The Thinking Person's Guide to Writing in the 21st Century. If you'd like to join us, you can do that now. Our toll-free number is available, and he'll only be with us up to the half-hour mark, so the time to call would be now. It's 866-733-6786, and you can join us. Don't need headphones, Steve. 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments right onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And you can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Let's say we're pretty much in agreement on a lot of things here as old English teacher. But students ask me sometimes to kind of give the essence of what can make better writing. And I think when I say we're in agreement and we're aligned on this, I'll say clear thinking makes clear writing, be concrete, and read as much as you can. I mean, if there are kind of three rules that cardinal rules that I try to dispense in my teaching, those are right at the top.
I completely agree. I would add show your work to someone else, because a big contributor to bad writing is a phenomenon called the curse of knowledge. Namely, when you know something, it's very hard to imagine what it's like not to know it. What's obvious to you, you think is obvious to everyone else, and it isn't.
Well, there's the old Vonnegut line, write for strangers. Because to some extent, when you're writing sometimes and you have a lot of knowledge, you think that you're dispensing it or disseminating it or whatever in a way that's clear or lucid, and it may not be the case at all.
Absolutely. And there's the old advice, keep in mind the writer over your shoulder. But it's not good enough, because we don't have mental telepathy, and so we can't really get in the heads of other people as much as we try. And there's no substitute for actually getting, showing it to a real flesh and blood person and say, do you understand this? And you'll often be surprised to find that what's obvious to you is not obvious to anyone else.
But someone particularly maybe with a good sense of style would be ideal. Yeah?
There are, you know, I got to say, there are these people who I infinitely admire, the pundits and columnists and people who can kind of crank out 800 words, hit send, and it reads perfectly well. But I'm not one of them, and most people are not in that category. Most people have to work over draft after draft. Ideally with feedback from other people, but sometimes it's enough just to come back to your own writing after some time has passed, so with a fresh pair of eyes. And you often, I find, I look at my drafts and I think, what did I mean by that? This didn't follow. What was I thinking?
I find when I go over a draft sometimes just awful repetition. You know,
absolutely.
I mean,
yeah.
Writing a book, you know, how could I have said that and then said it again later on? I mean, I like to think I'm generating ideas in some rhetorical way that moves forward and keeps moving forward.
And you can often see bad writing, bad books are ones where the author didn't bother to do that and left in the repetitions. So, and that's another bit of advice, and I'm sure you share this with your students as well. You got to revise. No, very few people are smart enough to both get ideas down on the page and have them expressed clearly. Generally, I find that that's at least a two-stage process where I take one pass over the writing with one goal in mind, and that is improve the quality of the writing.
I used to say three-stage process, pre-writing, writing, and rewriting.
And rewriting is crucial.
Yeah, absolutely. As crucial as the writing. Bill writes, what are the fundamental differences between the major dictionaries? Why would one use Merriam-Webster over American Heritage, over Oxford English, etc.?
American Heritage is better. No, I'm just saying that because I consult for them. That was a joke. You know, dictionaries are really, really good. They are based on, I think they're just magnificent works of scholarship, and I have tremendous admiration for all of the major dictionaries because they are based on evidence. They cultivate an ear for language as it's used by good writers, brilliant writers, competent writers, and they really give you a good way of anticipating what your readers are likely to expect. The OED, the Oxford English Dictionary, of course, is in a category
it's
by
sui
itself.
It's sui generis, yeah.
Yes, because it has examples of words as they've been used literally for 1,000 years or more. The Oxford English Dictionary is like a roach motel. Once a word goes in, it never comes out. So they don't delete words, unlike every other dictionary, where it would just get heavier and heavier, so you couldn't lift the thing.
Well, the OED, my original OED, coming with a magnifying glass.
I had the same thing, yes.
It was pretty heavy, actually.
Even miniaturized with a magnifying glass, it was heavy. Now, of course, it's online. But the OED, if you want to find out how a word was used in the 1800s what the first attested use in written English was, you go to the OED.
It's the etymology.
Yeah, so it's the etymology, exactly.
And again, we're talking to Steven Pinker. He'll be at the Commonwealth Club in Silicon Valley today, and he'll actually be at the JCC, San Francisco JCC? No, I think that's Palo Alto, isn't it?
Palo Alto this evening and San Francisco at noon today.
The Commonwealth Both Club at 7 p.m. tonight. Okay, and let's go to our callers. And Philip, you're first up. Philip, welcome.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for this program. I'm concerned about the use of WH questions when a noun clause is normally accepted, at least in prescription grammar. And so, for example, I know when did he arrive. I know when he arrived, we should say. I know who did he talk to. I know who he talked to.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What is the president? Everybody's using a WH question when a noun clause is... WH noun clause is prescriptive grammar.
Yeah, so it's the what's going on there is this peculiar rule of English where you invert the subject and auxiliary when you are asking a question. So you say when might he go, not when he might go. But when you embed the question in a clause inside a sentence, then you stick with the ordinary subject verb order. So when might he go? I know when he might go. So I know when might he go. I think that's the error that you're calling attention to. It's very common in kids. It's very common in people learning English as a second language because it's a complicated rule to keep track of. You switch the we and the can in a question, but if the question's inside another sentence, then you don't. To further complicate it, if you're quoting someone, if you say, he asked, when can we go, then you invert the subject and auxiliary after all. You don't say, he asked when he can go. although you can say he asked, I wondered when he can go. So the rules are complicated. It's not surprising that people learning English as a second language fail to keep track of them. I haven't heard that many examples in native English speakers. It's possible that some of them come from quoting, or at least in the mind of the speaker, they are quoting someone as opposed to reporting the content of what they said indirectly. And when you're quoting someone, then the error that you point to is not an error, and it's possible that that's why they put it that way.
Let me thank the caller. Just it comes to mind, you mentioned the president even uses that form of expression. President uses the word folks a lot, and I suppose maybe when he's doing community organizing, it was an appropriate word. But some of when you talk about the folks in ISIS, that sort of
yeah,
thing, it just it makes me cringe, and I don't understand the tone deafness to that.
And George W. Bush was notorious.
He was
for tone
deaf
folks.
In so many ways.
Well,
yeah.
Tone deaf, and among them, using folks as a synonym for people. I suspect that. They're in such a habit of using folks in talking about Americans in order to sound democratic, chatty, as we say, folksy, to eliminate distance between themselves and the people who are going to vote for them. They just get in a habit of referring to people as folks, and they forget that there are certain contexts in which that really is not appropriate.
We'll bring on more of your calls. We go on to Michelle. Good morning.
Good morning. Hi. I'm on the road right now heading to teach my freshman composition class at a South Bay Community College. And so how fortuitous to run into you guys. I wanted to tell you, can you hear me?
Yes. You've run into us. We can hear you.
Okay. I wanted to say that everything that Mr. Pinker is talking about is so echoes some of the things I haven't been able to even articulate to my students. And I thank you. I will be playing this episode at some point in my semester, but the things I wanted to bring up are about these hard and fast rules that high school teachers have taught my students who will say, but I thought you can't begin a sentence with a pause, or isn't it bad to have a question in the introduction? And, of course, I'll tell them that, I'll explain why that rule was made. I think Mr. Pinker was alluding to this. But it's a way to get them to stop doing the things that are wrong and to have, say, a fragment. But I'll say, hey, you can start a sentence with a clause. Just make sure that you have an independent clause attached to it, Or you can have a question in there. Just make sure you answer it at some point. And, my hope is that I can let them understand practically what it all means, not that it's just do this, do that.
Okay, Michelle, thank you. And Steve Pinker.
Yeah, and it's a legitimate question whether it's good pedagogy to teach young kids things that are false and then expect them to unlearn it when they get older. So even though I mentioned that some of the rules like never write in fragments, never begin a sentence with and.
Never split infinitives.
Never split infinitives should just not be in the rule books at any age. It's not useful for kids. It's not useful for adults. It's a completely bogus rule. But things like where to break a sentence. I think our caller has raised a legitimate point that is it good pedagogical practice to teach kids things that then you have to unteach when they get older? And I'm not so sure it is. And there may be more effective ways of getting kids to punctuate than giving them bogus rules like don't begin a sentence with and. Every good writer begins sentences with and.
What about when kids use things like, and this I think seeps into adult usage as well, like funner?
Oh, yes. It's actually been in the English language for quite some time, but it is something that you associate with kids. It's not illogical that because lots of words are both nouns and adjectives. Fun is originally a noun, but when you say that this is fun, it's actually ambiguous. It could mean it's in the category of fun, or it could mean like it's enjoyable. And once it's an adjective, there's no reason not to modify it with ER and EST. It's possible that the language will change and that in 50 years, funner and funnest will be just an unexceptionable part of the language. It's happened in the past, and it's been floating around in the margins of English for enough time that it could get a toehold.
Always enjoy having you on. Thank you so much for being with us. Wish it were an hour, but you got to go.
Thanks so much for having me.
Steve Pinker. Again, Stephen Pinker's new book is The Sense of Style. The Thinking Person's Guide to Writing in the 21st Century. He's also the author of The Language Instinct and The Blank Slate. And we're coming up on another segment, and so stay tuned for that. Dave Iverson will be joining us, a much-beloved host of Friday Forum for Forum on Fridays for quite some time when we return.